This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning. I'm Nupur Rawal, an assistant professor at UCLA in information studies. And today I'm so pleased and thrilled and honored to introduce my guest, Dr. Lisa Misery, a faculty in the Department of Anthropology at Yale University. She's also affiliated with the program in History of Science and Medicine at Yale. Her first book, Placing Outer Space, considers how planet is not only a cosmic concept, but also a humanistic one. And her new and second book, the one we're discussing today, titled In the Land of the Unreal, seeks to understand how the recent resurgence of virtual reality hinged on a belief that the technology could repair rifts in reality. She earned her PhD from MIT's program in History, Anthropology, and Science, Technology, and Society, and an SB, also from MIT, in Aerospace Engineering. Such a fascinating academic journey. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, for taking the time to engage with this work, and for just inviting me on for this conversation.
Likewise, I'm so excited to, you know, talk about some of the themes in your book, and it was just such a pleasure reading the book also. Our conversation today, of course, you know, is around your brand new and second book, In the Land of the Unreal, a book that focuses in equal parts on a community of women technologists, primarily building virtual reality, but also augmented reality applications, and doing that in LA. In that sense, the book, for our listeners, is anchored to what you call the technological terroir of Los Angeles as a city, and how it kind of bleeds and feeds into the VR fantasies and enterprises that ensue. So there's a lot to unpack here, of course, but if you could start us off with, you know, how you even came about to doing this project and how your background, academic training, as well as your prior book, perhaps, informed this specific project.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I started this project, those who are familiar with my first book and work on planetary scientists were perhaps a little confused as to how the two connected. But the more I got into the VR project, the more I realized there were deep connections. So as I was wrapping up writing Placing Outer Space, which you wonderfully described the central argument of, which is all about placemaking, mm-hmm. I was asking myself, you know, what's another emerging science or technology that is similarly challenging how we understand or think about place? And at that same time, I was asking that question to myself. I happened to be commuting to work one day, listening to NPR, mm-hmm. and they were talking about VR, and someone literally said, or not quite so literally, said, you know, VR is something that challenges the way we think about place. I was like, okay. I guess I will now spend the next 10 years of my life thinking about virtual reality. But the more I got into it, the more I realized that VR innovators are also world makers and world builders. And that was such a similar rhetoric and impulse behind the planetary scientists that I worked with. So I would say the biggest switch of these two projects was moving from a more laboratory science studies project to a technology studies project, which of course, even though STS encompasses both science and technology, to some extent they bifurcate in terms of different conversations and engagements. And so it was really an opportunity to take the conversation I'd been building about place with placing outer space and import it into a slightly different set of conversations and ideas.
Yeah, that explains, you know, the focus on also place and space that you have, which is, you know, part of what I want to ask you as we move forward. But I do want us to start actually with, you know, one of my favorite sort of vignettes in your book. So I'll describe it a little bit. And you start the book by, you know, telling us how you went to the U.S. premiere of this installation piece at LACMA, the L.A. County Museum of Art, in 2017. It's called Carne y Arena, and it was written and directed by the famous film director Alejandro González Iñárritu. And as you describe, the piece kind of draws attention to the realities of crossing the Mexico-U.S. border, but also the risks that people undertake in order to make that very treacherous journey to the US, right? And the draw of the piece, of course, that was that it used VR, or maybe I should say AR, with the intention of like creating an immersive and embodied experience, right? Getting into apparently the shoes of the people who make that very treacherous journey. But you also mentioned how, you know, the piece, and just by virtue of being in such a kind of rarefied space and also the public interest around it, it was really hard to find tickets to go to that. So there are obviously some issues that come up with it, but I was wondering if you can tell our listeners a little bit more about, you know, what was it like for you to go to the thing, and then how did it make you start thinking about the real, unreal, as well as the thematic stuff that comes up about fantasies and so on in your book?
Wonderful. So we all hope to find some kind of vignette that opens our project, that captures to some extent the scope of the project, right? Something that allows us to then use as a touchstone to explain what on earth we are doing with our work. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, I was able to procure tickets by being on my email at the right time in 2018 when Carne y Arena was installed at LACMA. It had premiered in 2017 at Cannes, mm-hmm. and then for its US premiere, it got a permanent installation at LACMA. And I was in LA for the duration of the calendar year 2018, carrying out my ethnographic research for this project. And the piece, which is actually entirely virtual reality, there are installation aspects of it, including you enter this space where it feels like a holding cell, you get very cold, you take off your shoes, you take off your jacket and your bag, and you put it in a cubby, and then you enter another room and you do the VR experience. In this room, the floor is covered with sand, a sharp sand, and two volunteers from the museum help you put on a VR headset and you put a backpack on and you enter a maybe 7 or 8 minute experience that was put together using motion capture. So it's quote unquote animated, but kind of in a somewhat photorealistic way. But in 2017, the photorealism possible in responsive room scale VR, as this is called, was not very high fidelity, but the VR experience is like dim. So you're not just... Right. It's not distracting to be with like these animated avatars to some extent, but as the experience proceeds, you get to see just some of the horrors and challenges of crossing the border, and wind is blown on your face. You feel like a helicopter is coming. There's a lot of sensorial overwhelm. So this piece became a really embodiment of a lot of the themes of the book. So the book is structured around three interlocking fantasies, all of which we can see evidence of in this piece. Right. So one of the fantasies is this idea of the fantasy of being, this idea that VR can help you be someone else or be somewhere else. Mm. This is tied up with this broader claim of an empathy machine, that VR, in exposing someone of privilege like myself, a white US citizen, to the experience of someone with less less privilege, a Latin American or South American border crosser, I can somehow better know what it is like to be in those shoes, as you were saying. So this fantasy, as you can even tell from my tone, is problematic. And that's a big thing that the book works through. But nonetheless, VR promises this fantasy of being somewhere else. The second fantasy that interweaves with this is the fantasy of place, which I mostly use to index what it means to be writing about technology in general and VR specific from Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So how this place of fantasy infused by Hollywood logics becomes a way of understanding technology that actually is quite distinct from how we might understand technology in the Bay Area, in the shadow of Silicon Valley. So what does Hollywood do for our understanding of emerging technology? And of course, because this is a piece by Iñárritu, this big Hollywood director, it is so telling of the fact that VR is not exclusively a Silicon Valley technology. It is also an LA and a Hollywood technology. And in fact, as I was waiting to enter this, the exhibit, I had gotten one of the first tickets of the day. So I was at LACMA before it even opened. And the only person in line was waiting for the ticket, you know, right before me. And I was chatting with her in line and, you know, she was working in the visual effects industry. And she was drawn to coming to see Carne y Arena because of who directed it. So that second fantasy really keys into how entertainment and Hollywood has been kind of an underexplored dynamic in technological development, at least within kind of STS and technology studies. And then the third fantasy of the book is this fantasy of representation. And primarily, I use it to talk about how there was this moment when I was doing fieldwork that was a little bit before and lasted for a little bit after, where there was this really distinctly articulated fantasy that women and people of underrepresented backgrounds could lead VR. And in fact, in through their leading VR, it would lead to a better industry, right? Because it would not fall prey to the same gender dynamics of either Silicon Valley or Hollywood, which was in the midst of its Me Too crisis when I was doing fieldwork. And so even though Iñárritu himself would not kind of fall within the fantasy of representation that I explicitly talk about, one of his big influencers who he thanked when he received an Oscar for this piece was Nani de la Peña, an LA-based journalist and professor who has really shaped the current moment of VR and who was a very important figure in this book in terms of articulating VR's good potential and just being a leading female figure in the industry that a lot of other younger women really looked to when seeing that they could be part of this field. And if you'll permit me just a couple more sentences.
Of course.
Carne y Arena encompasses the breadth of this book, which is sprawling as we are discovering. A couple of just very small things. One is, you know, he describes this piece as being semi-fictional ethnography. And of course, as an anthropologist, we love it when other people employ ethnography in their storytelling practices. And additionally, and I didn't find this, I had forgotten it and I hadn't found this until like maybe the second to last revision of the introduction of the book. In the artist statement that was installed in Cannes, which I didn't see, but was captured elsewhere, Iñárritu refers to VR in general and this piece in specific as a realistically unreal experience.
Right.
And that real unreal dynamic became something that is very important to this book. And the fact that he had kind of independently tagged VR as unreal also kind of was fascinating for me to discover and learn. And then finally, this book takes place in 2018 during the height of Trumpism. And part of what I was so interested is the fact that the empathy machine imaginary, this idea that VR could be a good technology, emerged during the Obama administration. And indeed, this piece is much more a relic of the Obama administration than anything else, because it's about when DACA is coming kind of to Congress at Obama's, you know, his advocacy. And this idea was like, oh, well, whoever the next liberal president is going to be, you know, we'll finally have a pathway to citizenship for undocumented undocumented immigrants, particularly children of undocumented immigrants. And to think about this piece instead within the context of the Trump administration, who within a month of me seeing this piece had rejected the DACA bill, just really pointed out that this unreality is not only a feature of VR, but also of US culture and politics. And I really have to work on my 5 minute, my elevator pitch on what the book is about, but that is what the book is about.
No, I think this is great. And I'm going to, you know, jump in and also say something because I think that will help us get into, you know, I would have just asked you, what is the real and the unreal? But I think there are so many times while reading the book that I felt like I found your words sort of in my mouth saying, wow. So, you know, every vignette or sort of going through the themes, there was an instantiation of like, this is real. And sometimes reality in your descriptions was within reach, right? But at the same time, it quickly became so unreal, or there was that abrupt realization that this is in fact unreal. And so I think there was also that tension of, including in this piece, if you will, you know, where I wanted to ask, like, so I'm glad that Inaritu kind of says, you know, that this is unreal, right? Like he's invested in having us understand that the claim here is not that you can actually just completely embody and unproblematically empathize and that's really where it ends. I think that line between what is real and what is unreal was really animated right from the start.
Yeah, thank you. I first started thinking with the language of the unreal very early on in my fieldwork because I'd gone on a studio tour at Paramount at the movie lot. And on the tour we watched a little clip, and that clip included from this movie, The Errand Boy from the 1960s, this phrase, like a narration phrase, "This is Hollywood, land of the real and the unreal." I was like, oh, that's interesting. And as I kind of learned how to live in LA, a city that you are becoming familiar with,
yeah,
I kept on tagging all of my experiences with, you know, unreal, like, oh, this is the land of the unreal. And it kind of became a colloquialism. I was thinking about how unreal actually has multiple registers, right? It can either be really positive, saying like, mm-hmm. oh, this chocolate cake is unreal.
Yeah.
Or it can be really negative. Oh my God, their behavior was unreal, mm-hmm. right? And I was like, oh, that's so interesting that this word can kind of go to either end of what we might consider lying in the middle of as reality. And as I got to the process of writing the book, I of course had to make a little bit more clear what my analytic claims about the unreal was. And I ended up defining it as the unreal signals moments when the multiplicity of reality demands attention. So to take the example of the Trump administration, for example, you know, I think a lot of liberal, white, you know, earnest, let's say, yeah. citizens, I would put myself into that bucket. As the kind of the Trump administration on alternative facts and just the sheer dismissal of certain people's lives and livelihood made this fracturing of reality seem much more apparent than for some people it had previously been. For others, for those living in marginalized identities and communities, reality's multiplicity has always been very apparent. Mm-hmm. But the unreal marks a moment when it demands attention, when the multiplicity of reality demands attention, and in the case that I write about, demands a repair. So unreal is not meant to signal some kind of new condition that here in, you know, the 21st century, we suddenly are no longer in reality or the hyperreal. We're now in the unreal. Rather, the unreal is meant to kind of mark a particular way of thinking about reality's multiplicity and fracturing that extends beyond before, you know, this book's research and I imagine well after.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I want to come back to that question of misinformation and kind of the rise of that misinformation discourse as well, and you know what maybe paranoid instinct was embedded in there, because I loved your treatment of the Trump era in the background, not as one of, as you say, of lamentation of the loss of a kind of reality that people thought they had, but I want to begin with, you know, you've arranged things along the lines of three themes, and I want to begin with the fantasy of place. So starting with the question of VR and placemaking and spacemaking, how do you tackle that relationship between VR technologies and LA as a place in your book? Like what was that Hollywood connection, or even beyond Hollywood, what is LA's investment in creating VR fantasies?
So in my first book, I was writing all about how experts made place, right? So in order to make sense of their objects of study, planets were transformed into worlds. And through these techniques of placemaking, scientists made sense of the objects of their study. In this project, the figure and ground of place kind of flips, where instead of thinking about how science and technology make place, I became interested in how place makes or influences the development of science and technology, in this case, of course, virtual reality. And you brought up the phrase earlier, technological terroir. This is a phrase that a friend of mine, Nikki Hemmer, kind of gifted to me one early day when I was just starting to think about what this research might be. And we were drinking wine and kind of swirling the liquid. I was saying, like, I'm really interested in how place kind of just creates a unique way of a way a technology might emerge, which is in some sense, I'll admit, like a banal, but it became very important for this project. And, you know, she mentioned like technological terroir. And of course, there's such a lineage of thinking about terroir within the space of science and technology, particularly Heather Paxson's work. So it seemed like a really interesting phrase to think about. And particularly in the United States, right? How do we understand within a place of power, including California, like, so not just like East Coast versus West Coast, but even within a single state, how might there nonetheless be different logics that accompany technological development and deployment? And obviously in LA, Hollywood looms large in the creative industry and the kind of amongst the class that I primarily conducted my field work with. So LA itself became it gave me two different ways of thinking about the significance of place for VR. One was the political economy of Hollywood and how that impacted VR's development and gave me a way of thinking about how to imagine a different categories of technology such that they don't kind of collapse into a monolith. So in this case, I think about a cinematic technology versus an emerging technology. So there's a ripe history of technology within Hollywood because of movie cameras and CGI and all these other technologies that make the movies and particularly the blockbusters that we consume. But that's kind of a distinct pattern of development than say an emerging technology like AI or flying cars or robots that is kind of seen as the domain of Silicon Valley. And VR is really fascinating because it is both a cinematic technology and a emerging technology. So something that both Silicon Valley and Hollywood have a domain of expertise around. And part of what I trace is the frictions that come from these different ways of thinking about technology and its development and deployment. So that's one way in which kind of place comes to matter in the first part, the fantasy of place part of the book. And the second way is even when I was writing my first book about planetary science, I always had a soft spot for the LA School of Urban Studies and people like Mike Davis and Ed Soja and others who theorized LA as this quintessential postmodern city.
Nice.
And I was excited to engage with that literature. And in the end, particularly with other non-native theorists of LA, like Baudrillard and Echo, who described LA in their visits to Southern California in the 70s as hyperreal. So already kind of keying into some way in which LA allowed these theorists to think about reality and what reality was becoming. And I found that I personally was similarly inspired by the city for very different reasons than these earlier scholars, but LA nonetheless triggered my imagination and helped me think not only about the city, but through thinking about the city gave me insight into ways to think about VR as well.
Yeah. just to offer, you know, 2 points to what you said, and maybe there's a question in there too. So the first point is, while reading your book, you know, there's this movie that came out recently, a documentary by Frederick Weissman, who focuses on this Michelin star restaurant in the countryside in France. And it's a 4 hour long movie that is pretty much an exploration of the concept, if you will, of terroir, right? Like, he goes to the soil, he really gets to the root of where the grape comes from, where the cheese comes from, this and that, and what eventually trickles into what people identify as good taste or refined cuisine. And so while I was watching that, I was actually thinking about your book and your argument, because I think it gave a very generative way of thinking that, especially when it comes to conceptualizing place and talking about technology in technology studies broadly. I think a lot of us, including myself, struggle with 2 things. One is, what is the importance of place, right? How do we talk about something that feels so universal, which is technology, just landing or perhaps unfolding in a place? And why should we even spend time talking about contexts of technology, production or deployment? So that was one thing that I thought you did very beautifully with this engagement with LA as a city. And the second thing I think is also, even as we write those accounts, I can myself never escape the shadow of Silicon Valley, because I think the implicit question is always, how is place X different to Silicon Valley? Or, you know, it's always about how is it not Silicon Valley? And what is the story about? So I was wondering if you have any thoughts on this.
That's a really beautiful observation. And I thought a lot with Sherry Ortner's book for this. I thought a lot with Sherry Ortner's work for this project. Yeah. And of course, she has the book called Not Hollywood, which is about the independent film industry. And to some extent, I had a tagline for a while, but this changed, of my book maybe being Not Silicon Valley. Like, you know, there's other ways of thinking about technology, but I completely agree with you that reference to Silicon Valley, I don't think always serves us as analysts. And I, of course, reference it a little bit, right? You know, I make reference to the Californian ideology, and I propose that part of what the authors of the Californian ideology do in their work is they articulate a technological terroir of the Bay Area. And then I note that my project is therefore to articulate a Southern Californian ideology, or the technological terroir of Southern California, that offers distinct ways in which technology is imagined and realized. And at the same time, I'm very conscious of the fact that I am studying this in another power center, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like, so Hollywood kind of comes to stand in for all of the challenges that those of us who write about technology often confront when we're thinking about Silicon Valley in terms of capitalism and, you know, the workforce and all the other kind of myriad of dynamics that come with these supremely moneyed global enterprises and locations, which is part of the tension that you just acknowledged, which is, we are used to thinking of technology as universal things that travel, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, all of us who are in technology studies, we know that that's not true. We know that when technology touches down, something different happens. And the question is, how do we as analysts come up with frameworks for thinking about that relationship between place and technology? And I'll just kind of plug a piece I have forthcoming in American Anthropologist that will be out in the fall, mm-hmm. in which I take the findings of this book, but condense them into a methodological essay that provides ethnographers in particular of technology a way to think about place and to wrestle with the simultaneously pulls of the universal and the particular when we seek to understand technology's meaning in places and worlds.
Beautiful. Wow. I'm excited to read that. I think we need more thinking along the lines of place in technology. So I look forward to that. Yeah, moving to the second section of the book, which is about fantasies of being. Mm-hmm. Let's kind of just open it up with what you call the empathy machine, right? So what did you see, and kind of how are you talking about empathy as against, you know, vis-a-vis VR?
The project began with my concern about the imaginary of the empathy machine, which was formally coined by Chris Milk in a TED Talk in 2015, but builds on conversations about the relationship between VR and empathy and societal betterment and goodness that predates Milk. And again, the story of it really originates a lot with Nani de la Peña's thinking and writing. And, you know, as someone who is in technology studies and in STS, we all have collectively learned, documented, worried about how technologies embody the norms of those who create it and how often those norms end up resulting in the propagation of harms.
Yeah.
So obviously, Sophia Noble's Algorithms of Oppression, Ruha Benjamin's Race After Technology, all of these books were coming out as I was writing this, doing the fieldwork and writing up the project. And even when I first heard The Empathy Machine in 2015, it was enough to send my anthropology sensibilities on alert. And I was not the only one, right? If you read kind of the the engagement with this concept, it's been very critical from the start. And Lisa Nakamura has, I think, an excellent and definitive piece, Feeling Good About Feeling Bad, which unpacks and critiques the logic of the empathy machine. But regardless, that logic of the empathy machine is exactly what we see embodied in Inuritu's piece, which we talked about at the top of this podcast. And by the time I was in the field, which was 2018, the VR community itself was already starting to realize the problematics of the empathy machine. In some sense, the critique worked, right? Just the general tech lash that was beginning was already being felt by this community. So I didn't enter a techno-optimist, techno-solutionist community that I thought or was even worried about that I might. So I kind of came ready to like be like, no, empathy machine, it's racial erasure. I was like ready to go to the mat, like change the community in the world. And they were like, yeah, no, we know this is bad. Wow. Like, you know, we're working, we're changing ourselves. Like instead of us telling other stories, we're partnering with the communities whose stories want to be told. And I was like, oh, well, that seems pretty good. You know, like, So I thought in the book, it was very important for me to trace the history of how VR became an empathy machine. And of course, one of the things I found in tracing that history is that the empathy machine claim in the first case, which a lot of scholars presume is connected to the tech lash and connected to the longer conversation about the harms of technology. Actually, the phrase, the empathy machine, comes from Roger Ebert. On the occasion of him getting a Walk of Fame, a star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, he said that, you know, film is an empathy machine that basically brings us into other people's worlds. And when Chris Milk called VR the ultimate empathy machine, he was riffing on Roger Ebert. He was riffing on a cinematic and a conversation about storytelling as opposed to a conversation about technology. So it really forced me to locate the empathy machine as something that isn't coming from Silicon Valley or in conversation with Silicon Valley directly, though, of course, Silicon Valley picked it up. Facebook/Meta picked it up and kind of created this whole VR for good branch that they recently just laid off all the people that were employed in that branch. That's a different story. And so it is a very LA story, the empathy machine emergence. And I therefore use Nani de la Peña to kind of trace out how this claim that VR could make better humans came to be, and to acknowledge the critique, which is primarily a racial critique, right? That in trying to embody another's life world to better understand it, you devalue first-person accounts and testimonials of those who live in these worlds. And you also risk erasing the need to be in community with those, because in doing these hyper real VR experiences, you feel as though you have connected when of course you haven't. And Sherry Turkle has a really hauntingly beautiful line in writing about VR and other technologies of intimacy, saying that what happens with them is that the feeling of conversation becomes conversation enough. And I think that's exactly what the risk of the VR empathy machine is that I talk about within the fantasy of being framework. So because the critique of the empathy machine was already happening and ongoing when I was doing my field work, I wanted to spend some time in the book after doing the critique and rehearsing the critique of saying, can this vision, can this fantasy be salvaged? Can there be any redeeming use of this technology that allows for this kind of community building and development between people who have very different life experiences? And that brought me into the company Embodied Labs. And their VR was being used as a tool for health, for professional caregivers who worked with elderly clients. And it still fell into some of the traps of the empathy machine critique. But what I thought was really telling about why this company felt different from other VR experiences like Carne y Arena was that the people for whom this VR experience was intended were care workers who were already in community with the people that the VR experiences was meant to represent and embody. So it kind of fit into a tool, one of many tools in a toolkit that allowed these care workers to do their job and do their job well and better. And it didn't replace being in community or being in conversation. It augmented being in community and conversation. And that distinction between replacement and augmentation is, I think, a really important rubric for how we think about technology. One that I develop by drawing on and using Kalindi Vora and Adamski's Surrogate Humanity book.
Absolutely. And then to tease out something that I think you're implying, even as you explain the empathy machine and, you know, perhaps not its completely dystopic uses or, you know, some amount of criticality that gets folded into that practice. The thing I found striking is, I think your book and the narrative it presents does offer us another way to think about or another glimpse and instance of, you know, who is being asked to empathize. Because I think the dominant sort of claim and imagination when we talk about access to technology, right? And when we're thinking with things like Facebook as a platform or any kind of big social media platforms, is that no one seems to challenge this notion that technology and mass access to technology, you know, brings democracy, right? Or that technology is for everyone. And in some ways it erases the differences of class and race and gender and saying, no, it's really for everyone. But I thought that the stories you tell, VR seems to be in service of making empathy happen for perhaps a very elite group of users. I don't know if that's true.
No, absolutely. That's really insightful. When I was trying to figure out what this conversation about the empathy machine and VR as an empathy machine, what it was similar and not similar to, it fell into the broader category of tech for good. And if you look at most of the tech for good projects and their critiques by STS scholars, you see that often it's this idea that tech can be deployed in the global South to right. spread democracy and to end poverty, right? Like I'm thinking of Morgan Ames's brilliant book, The Charisma Machine, in which she traces the disaster of one laptop per child. And here is a case in which the good intention of the technology is to service the people who already benefit from technology, the elite, the privileged, to provide empathy for those who, because they are so privileged, might possibly lack empathy for those who are otherwise. And it's just kind of like when you begin to unpack the whole like logic of it, it becomes quite devastating in a way. But you're 100% correct that this really differs from other tech for good projects because it serves those who already have positions of privilege with regard to their relationships with technology.
Did you at all get a chance to talk to the care workers that were using the technology in the Embodied Labs case?
I went on one site visit. I didn't have IRB
right.
like clearance to do a user study. So I couldn't kind of interview them directly. But the one site visit I went on with the CEO of Embodied Labs, Carrie Shaw, I write about it in the book. And I was just observing the training that she was doing. And what struck me was that these were women, two were, I would say, middle-aged or slightly older than middle-aged white women, and one younger Black woman. And they were effusively excited to have this technology because it told them that they were valued. Because in this case, it was deploying technology for a community that doesn't often get to be who gets to like kind of have emerging technologies in their hands. And they just were so excited to be valued in this way. And, you know, again, one could be critical of the kind of hegemonic attitude that might lead to them being excited about being valued by technology. But the conversation I had with them, or that I kind of was able to observe, was so thoughtful. And they brought up the problems. They noted that for some care workers, some of these experiences could be quite triggering, right? Because part of being a care worker is actually tamping down your empathy and knowing that what you're doing is a job. And this is something that Puig de la Bella Casa talks about in her kind of thinking about care and the non-innocence of care that Murphy and others have developed, which is that, why do we expect care workers to be empathetic?
Yep.
It's a job. And so they can do the job. And so some of those concerns were raised by the care workers, even as they were overwhelmingly positive toward being the kind of the people who were getting lavished with these technologies and attention.
I personally don't think that is sort of surprising or out of place at all, because I think, again, as your book talks about it, this is a very shiny toy. This is a very rarefied technology. And even as we see the demos by, you know, Apple and whatnot, I think all of us do have this imagined relationship that we're all not going to be able to afford or have some of these things in our hands right away, at least. Mm. Right. So I think the fact that I've myself seen that, you know, that it's not totally an accident or whatever, that when some of these really shiny pieces of technology do make landfall in communities where they have never expected or imagined to be the primary or imagined users of them, they, of course, you know, there's a lot of excitement around the fact of just like having access to them, right?
Yeah. And it becomes, as you're saying, like, how do you then maintain that, right? That's the biggest problem when you're deploying technologies and communities that don't have all the infrastructure to maintain them. And it is, that is something that Embodied Labs, I think, continues to think about, especially as like the platforms get outdated, the headsets get outdated. Like, right. That's a big challenge of their company.
Not to mention that, you know, there isn't necessarily space to put your own visions into what the technology should be doing, even if you have access to the headset or whatever, right? So,
yeah, though I will say that Embodied Labs is a really nice partnering model in terms of creating VR experiences that are that are seen as needed by the clients and the communities that they're serving. So they have a very open collaborative process for creating new VR content that is always in dialogue with who they see as their primary customers.
Oh, wow. That's actually refreshing.
Yeah. That's why I profiled them, because I was like, I want to tell a good story about VR. And I met Shaw, and I was like, this seems like a group I can tell a good story.
Yeah. So actually that brings us to, you know, the third section of your book, which is honestly, it's a book in itself, is about, again, challenging the myth or perhaps the dominant imagination of who makes VR, right? And it's not for nothing that we all think that most people making VR technology, the software, the hardware, everything, are possibly men and also often white men. But you focus on women's maker communities. And again, their sort of conscious shift of talking about, you know, why they should be at the forefront of this and why they should be even involved in making some of this stuff. So can you talk about the women communities that you focused on?
Happily. So when I was starting to kind of create this project, I began with the empathy machine. And every time someone would say something about the empathy machine, I would look up where they were, and often they would be based in LA. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Mm. And then I was beginning to notice, oh, and often actually they're women. That's curious. And then I found that there was this Women in VR Facebook group that I joined, and I could see kind of the networking and community building that was happening virtually. And again, a lot of the events being hosted were being held in LA. So I was very excited, because actually when I first started doing this project on VR, I thought I'd have to go to Silicon Valley, and I did not want to live in the Bay Area again. I was like, yes, LA, palm trees, you know, Baudrillard, I was psyched. But you know, this notion of women in VR is really complex.
Mm.
And it grew and changed and morphed over the course of my research and fieldwork. At first, it was kind of part of just kind of like a popular feminism approach of like, yes, industry should be diverse. Let's celebrate women and underrepresented voices in this space. In the wake of the Me Too movement, the reporting on Harvey Weinstein happened in October 2017, and I moved to LA in January 2018, right after Hollywood kind of announced its Time's Up campaign about pay equity for creative talent in the industry. And so the question about female representation was newly loaded and recharged in LA. But of course, the Me Too movement predates the Hollywood arm of it and also is very much a global movement that happens in all sorts of places. But in LA, it felt like a local movement, right? Because this was about Weinstein, this was about Hollywood, yeah. This was about the casting couch and all that stuff. So there was a political energy that persisted around women in VR longer than I think it would have had Me Too not happened, and also had Trumpism not happened, and the, you know, grab her by the pussy and that kind of thing not happened. So all of those were really alive for the community I worked with. And the other thing that my research helped me understand was this promise of VR as an empathy machine, this promise that VR could be a good technology, was held up by the promise of women leading the field. Because the idea was that in order for VR to be a good technology, it had to have a good industry behind it, which is kind of like STS 101, you know,
right.
Like technologies aren't naturally good. They're kind of reflective of their creators. Somehow that got into the, you know, the water in the LA community and filtered in. But so that's all very interesting. But then accompanying that, you begin to get somewhat challenging claims, which are the reason, and this is claims I encountered on my fieldwork that were articulated by the women I spoke with. The reason women are best suited to lead this industry is because we are more empathetic. Women are more empathetic. And so packed within this attempt at a kind of, you know, gender diverse representation liberal ethos was, of course, gender essentialism. Mm-hmm. And as we know from our, you know, as our good scholars that we know that often essentialisms, rather than upsetting the structures that maintain, the structures that create the dichotomies and binaries to begin with, often end up reifying those binaries and dichotomies such that the kind of change one might hope for and imagine are undermined by the essentialist arguments that seem on the surface to be in service of it. So that kind of complexity is part of what I'm trying to get at in this third part, which thank you for acknowledging that itself is its own book. That's like the problem of this whole book is it's three books really, but I wanted to do it in one book. And, you know, the other thing is, at the same time, there is a fair amount of women who succeeded, who really were able to make a different kind of career for themselves by affiliating with VR. And that's when kind of all of the fantasies begin to come together, the fantasy of place, the fantasy of being, the fantasy of representation, because it was in LA precisely because it was removed to some extent geographically from Silicon Valley, but of course not entirely ideologically, but geographically it did feel apart that women were able to kind of, build a different story for themselves around their relationship with technology that created career opportunities in kind of unexpected ways. This was not widely replicable, but for a few, it worked. And because they were so visible, other women in the industry were like, oh, maybe this could work for me too. So for all of those reasons, this fantasy of women in VR and this fantasy of representation persisted actually quite longer than one might have expected the conversation and the action around it to have persisted.
It's funny you say that because it reminded me of a section in your book where you cue it up, you talk about, you know, what it means to be a woman in tech and then how your visits and conversations and interactions with women in tech in LA challenged sort of the imaginations of what roles and skills and so on women in tech have or should be having. And I say this because as someone who teaches librarians and archivists and people in an information studies department. I think it has been a bit of a struggle, but also I think a good type of a challenge to, for all of us, me and my students, to say, actually, a woman in tech is not always someone who just does coding or just does design, right? There's so many other skills and roles that all fall under this umbrella. And I wonder if you want to speak to that.
That's so fascinating. So yeah, like when I got to LA, the previous places I have lived that are relevant for this are Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the shadow of MIT. And I had done fieldwork in Silicon Valley for my first book. And so I felt very comfortable that I kind of knew what a woman in tech was. Like, I had been a woman in tech when I was studying engineering. I had spent a lot of time with women in tech socially over, you know, just over because of the communities that I moved through. And when I got to LA and I started meeting women and they were like, oh yeah, I'm a woman in tech, I'm a woman in VR, I would kind of go, great, so what do you do? And I would be expecting, exactly as you were saying, someone who would be a coder or a developer. And instead, they were a producer or an actor or a storyteller or a world builder. And at first, I got very nervous because I was like, oh no, I'm an anthropologist of technology. I came to study women technologists, and like, I'm not seeing any women technologists. But then I realized I had stumbled into the romanticized position of the anthropologist, which is that the familiar here was strange. And what I had to do was understand that the way technology was being deployed and the way that the title of a woman in tech was being invoked was actually different than how I had otherwise encountered it. And it indexed a different set of expertise. And these were expertise that are, of course, more germane to LA, sorry, they're more germane to LA and Hollywood. And so it just kind of changed not only what a woman in tech was, but what tech meant. And that gets back to the whole technological terroir argument, which is to claim that thinking about place is not just kind of a geographic or spatial imaginary, but it actually means that there are different varietals of tech that grow in different places, to the extent that even the word tech comes to signify a slightly different flavor, a slightly different association of things and meanings.
I had not thought of that. That's amazing. I agree with you totally. And even as, you know, we talk about then who gets to participate, what women you saw, how they were challenging some of these definitions. The other point that stood out for me, and I'm sure you saw this in your time as well, that as with any kind of big city, especially US cities, I think there's this tension of who is a native, who was born and raised in the city, and what type of stakes they have, versus kind of what are called the LA transplants, or, you know, same in the Bay Area and so on. And you have this beautiful conversation with someone who is a native Angeleno, a woman born and raised perhaps in LA, and tries to participate in these communities that are about inclusion and diversity and all that, but she still somehow doesn't feel like she quite belongs, right?
Yes, yes. That was, I had arrived in LA, I posted on the Facebook Women in VR Facebook group that I was there for a year. I'd love to meet people. And Angie, as I kind of call her in the book, had messaged me. And, you know, we struck up a friendship throughout the year. And she was always very insistent on showing me the real LA. I was living on the West Side. I was mostly at West Side institutions. And she was like, no, come to the East Side. come to other places. Not East Side in terms of Silver Lake, right? Like, so kind of come to places with me. Watching her try to infiltrate this space taught me so much, and she theorized so much, right? Like, she was thinking about her own positionality as someone who identified as kind of queer and non-binary, who didn't go to college, who is not white, right? She had a lot of ways in which she desired to be part of this community, but recognized that there was something about this community that wasn't for her. And this community was, there was actually a lot of people who didn't go to college in this community. There was a lot of, you know, queer representation. There was a lot of non-white active participants. So it wasn't only about identity that Angie was struggling with. It was also just about, like, as you're saying, a sense of, like, even thinking about what this place is and could be for someone. And I just saw her repeatedly being shown the promise of the fantasy of representation and not being able to achieve that fantasy and struggling with why that was. And I think, you know, she more than me is, you know, the best theorist and understander of her own story and situation within the this larger social space.
Yeah, I agree with you. If one feels when one lives in a city, you know, the kind of suspicions perhaps and instincts that this might be true. I think for me, that story reinforced these kind of whispers or throwaway comments that I do hear from a lot of people as they move about LA, you know, trying to perhaps stake a claim, right? And repeatedly emphasize to people also that there are these multiple LAs. And it's, I love it. I love the fact that you animate the concept of fantasy really as something that is, but is also unreal and unachievable, because I think that's precisely what these people are talking about when they say, I see the LA you're talking about, but it's also not within my reach. Moving on to our next set of questions. I did want to circle back to, again, there's something that you allude to, right? And it's perhaps one might laugh it off, you know, when they call it VR's feminine touch, like the relationship between women and what they do, and women who are as gendered bodies that are often theorized or stereotyped actually as the holders and the vessels of empathy and care and this and that. That's what the feminine touch is. But then there's also a more serious way of looking at, as you alluded to, you know, what can women bring to the visions and fantasies of VR? Because we're often complaining about how these visions are hijacked by people who do not have the radical imaginative capacity to think about or to dream up good futures, right? So I wonder if you have something to say to the when people are talking about the VR's feminine touch.
Yes. So the learning I did while writing this book, which again, as we mentioned, was something that began from a critical instinct, a nervousness about the empathy machine rhetoric, to when I was in the final stages of revising, you know, reading through the final drafts of it, which is by that point, we're in the midst of the pandemic, mm-hmm. and Facebook is rebranding as Meta and saying that our future is in the metaverse, and then Apple comes out with spatial computing. And what I realized is that this book becomes a moment when technology was being thought about differently. Mm. And if we as critical scholars, every time we see a different fantasy, come and shoot it down because of its flaws, we then resign ourselves to the dominant narrative, the ideology coming from Silicon Valley, re-grabbing hold of the narrative about what technology ought to be. So for all the imperfections of the empathy machine, of the essentialized kind of notion of a woman's touch is what's making, you know, could make VR succeed, what I learned to appreciate about the community that I wrote about was at least they were trying to say VR could be something else. At least they were trying to say VR could be a nonfiction cinematic, you know, experience. It could be creativity. It could be about empowerment. And if we are too quick as scholars to damp down that voice, because it's easier to squish that voice than it mm-hmm. is to squish the Silicon Valley voice, then we walk ourselves into a corner. And so I just spent a lot of this project wondering what comes next for critical technology studies in terms of we've made the critique quite yes. incredibly. How do we then help build out a different future for technology?
I love it so much. I have just started reading Ruha Benjamin's new book, mm-hmm. which is, you know, literally called The Imagination, a Manifesto. And I think a lot of us who are also in education talk about the necessity to keep animating and keep holding on to the space of optimism or at least avenues of intervention. So I agree with you to that extent. I think a point where you, again, like emphasize this and for me, really beautifully brought together the fine line that we walk was, I think you have a line that says something like, what's perhaps common between an abolitionist and then also someone in the job of VR with very different outcomes and goals is, I think, that commonality of the fantasy of what a technology can do. Like, they're both excited about doing something with it, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. And then moving on to my final question, which is really about truth and information and the misinformation questions. I think there's a through line of interpretation and misinterpretation and VR's role as an interpretative technology in the book, right? So VR doesn't just show us the world always as is, but as you show through the conversations on what the community wants to build, there are interests in kind of making a world building. And then there's also the institutional players' interest in, you know, showing us fantasy worlds and the hyperreal. And then there in your book, there's the responses to emerging to the Trump era politics, also informing the content and direction of VR projects. So essentially, I guess, as is the foundational argument in so much science and tech studies, building VR fantasies is, of course, a morally and politically loaded question as well. You quote this podcast conversation where the host is talking to someone who is now defected and disillusioned, a former employee of a VR firm, and they arrive to this conclusion that the reality is a lot different than they as VR makers talk about. And I was wondering if you wanted to comment on just this wrangling with, you know, what is truth, information, misinformation in the context of VR technologies.
Yeah, so that was a conversation that was on Kent Bai's Voices of VR podcast, which itself is this amazing archive of thousands, of oral histories effectively with VR creators starting in 2014. So like a lot of the pieces I had missed in my own kind of canvassing, I was often able to find pieces of it within Bai's archive. So I hope future scholars turn to that as well as an amazing source of information. But this podcast was published in 2021 and it was after the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. And the insurrection bookends, weirdly enough, bookends this project. And, you know, when I was doing it, I was like, oh no, is this like the way that like 9/11 started like every book that was written between like 2002 and 2006? You know, am I just like pulling into some kind of like national trauma? But it really like, so I was worried about that. I was worried that I was reading too much into Trumpism being VR, like being an alternative reality. And like what happened, I was worried I was reading too much into January 6th being some kind of like cosplay, immersive like theater experience, that the language I was using to describe VR became the language that I was hearing political commentators talking about it. They use the language of an unreal. They use the language of fantasy. The way they were talking about January 6th was how I had been talking for the last 4 years in writing this book about VR. And I was just kind of like, man, am I doing too much with this? And then I listened to this podcast, and the podcast was recorded also in January 2021. And the kind of very organically, the podcast host and the interviewee spiraled into the insurrection and seamlessly connected the insurrection with the own thinking they've been doing about the VR community. In this case, it was someone saying how they quit their job because of the toxic positivity, as he called it, of the VR industry, such that there was no room for dissent. And so he kind of, when Trump got elected originally, on one of the Slack channels, he started like kind of posting about how, you know, but the horribleness of Trumpism and making sure everyone knew. And he got told not to. He got told that this was apolitical. And trying to square like this political project of VR being an empathy machine with kind of the sentiment of VR's, like the enthusiasm about VR as like this apolitical space that is going to be our future, was something that this interviewee just couldn't hold in his head. And the kind of connections he was drawing between kind of the politics and the fantasies of technology I guess, validated my own stringing together of the political economy that undergirded the community as I was writing about it. And it just kind of validated my bookending as not something that was gimmicky or my own like kind of psyche in my head, but really something that spoke and scaled across politics, industries, technologies, et cetera.
Absolutely. I found myself nodding vigorously because I think there is a need for and also perhaps a scarcity of those type of nuanced articulations that can help us hold these realities together without necessarily becoming defeatist or lamenting about the loss of something that, you know, we've always wanted, right? So thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. I had to struggle to not give away all the amazing vignettes and concepts that you put forward in the book. So I sincerely hope that the listeners actually now go and engage with the book in full detail. Before we leave you, I would love to know if there are new projects that you're working on or what directions you're thinking in.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for your really amazing questions. And I so appreciated your own reflections on, you know, being a teacher in LA and also the kind of research that you're doing. And I just am really anticipating reading some of your work in the near future. So this book coming out, that's a big thing. And then I actually, the day before we're recording this, I had a co-authored piece in Nature on AI and scientific understanding and a call to be wary of presuming AI is going to make better science. So that was an incredibly exciting project I did with my co-author, Molly Crockett, who's a cognitive scientist at Princeton. And, you know, with those, with this book coming out and getting a little bit of traction within the VR community and with that piece in Nature coming out, what it has allowed me to do is actually reach a much wider audience than my previous work has allowed in terms of like spreading the good word about STS, you know, and like, you know, I started my own journey as being an STS scholar in 2006. And there is something different that's happening right now in terms of how scientists and technologists and engineers are open to the conversations and critiques that we're offering. And so I don't entirely know what's coming next, but I'm really excited about all this hard work that we've been doing as a community, finding the audience that I personally have always wanted it to find, which is engineers, scientists, and technologists, to help them be better scientists, engineers, and technologists. So I hope you'll see me swimming in those circles in the near future.
I'm sure we will. And I hope that you come by LA and we can have those conversations in person as well.
Fantastic.
All right. Thank you so much again. And have a good day.
Thank you. You too.